Good evening, and welcome to yet another episode of The Last Knock. Your friends in horror since Mekong Delta 1971. Wait, flashback. 2013, I mean, 2013. My name is Johnny Numb. Joining me tonight, as always, is...
Billy Crash.
Private First Class, yeah.
Again? Can I be a colonel for once? Can I be a colonel? God damn, fuck.
And tonight, we are talking about the 1990 film Jacob's Ladder on the occasion of its 30th anniversary.
Incredible.
Yes.
Incredible.
And you know, yeah, we'll talk about the movie, the performances, the aesthetics, all that good stuff. But Bill, you kind of know me, and I'm always curious to hear stories about how people first encountered movies. Like, how did you first see Jacob's Ladder? Did you see it in the theater, or did you catch up with it on video? Like, when did you first see it, and what were your impressions when you saw it?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that. It was released on November 2nd of 1990, and when it came out, it was the number one at the box office for the first weekend. But then... Okay. Then the next weekend, everybody's like, oh, Child's Play 2, and they went for the doll. And so that was that. But so I didn't see this in the theater. I was at home, and I don't know. I was watching it on television. I don't know if it was a rental or not. And I just remember being like, holy shit, like, what, this movie, oh my God. You know, it was just very intense and mind-blowing, frightening. Which is rare for me with horror, because it's just, you know, Adrian Lynn, who directed this, did not take a placid approach to this at all. Written by Bruce Joel Rubin. Get more into that later. Whose script is insane. And I was just like blown away by the psychological terror of it. You know, it is listed as a dramatic horror, but this is true psychological horror that is extremely compelling. Tim Robbins, you know, who was doing mostly comedy and support roles at the time, took this. Tom Hanks is the only one I know for sure turned the role down because he wanted to do the fucking Bonfire to Vanities fiasco movie.
Right.
And Tim Robbins was like, Adrian Lynn had to like talk him into it. And I'm like, these performances are so intense with him, Elizabeth Pena, the late great, we lost her a year ago, Danny Aiello. A lot of people don't, you know that Pruitt Taylor Vince, the great character actor, was in it as well. Jason Alexander, not in a comedic role. Eric LaSalle, Ving Rhames.
Matt Craven,
yes, absolutely. Lewis Black is in the film.
That's right. He plays the doctor in that one.
He plays the doctor. And a very, very young, unknown, and uncredited Macaulay Culkin was in this film. And I'm watching this, and the movie is filmed beautifully. Cinematography was by Jeffrey L. Kimball. And it was just so engaging, so gripping. And it's funny because like Kimball went on to do a lot of action films, like Top Gun, Star Trek Nemesis, Paycheck, Mission Impossible 2. But it's like he brought that like that flair, and he kept it dark, and he kept it gritty, and the whole story was gritty, and the whole story had these like moments of like almost like you're waiting for Tim Robbins' character to like figure out like what the hell's going on in my head, in my world, and we're trying to figure out what's going on screen, and it was just very unsettling. So I'm watching this at home, and I'm like, what the fuck? I'm like freaking out, you know? And it's like. And I read in an article, it was fantastic, from Jack Beresford from Den of Geek. He wrote that when he was going to see the film, someone before him ran out of the theater and said, if I ever meet the guy that wrote that movie, I'll kill him. You know, it was because he was so messed up by it. And this is like one of the, it's on my best of all time list. It's been on many other people's lists for one of the movies you have to see before you die and all that stuff. Yeah. And I was just like knocked out in the ending. you know, the ending just like, I think I fell off the couch, you know, it was just like just totally wiped out.
Yeah, you know, the ending, well, I mean, we'll probably talk about it in certain terms as we go along,
right.
But that ending is very compelling because it's strangely like quiet, you know, it's like,
yes,
I don't want to say it's like it's defeated, but it's just kind of like there's an acceptance to the ending, I guess.
Yeah, and it's gasp worthy. It's just like, it's like, oh, now I get the whole movie. It was one of those, like, if people loved The Sixth Sense and was like, holy crap, that ending, it's like this was before The Sixth Sense, and it's one of those holy crap endings, you know. It's like it's one of the best endings in all of horror and maybe even all of cinema to me, you know. What an intense movie, man.
Yeah, no, Bill, that was beautiful. Everything you just said was beautiful.
No, thank you. I'm done. Take over. Let me know when the show's over.
Yeah, okay, no problem. I'll pick it up from here. you know what, Bill? This movie had been a gap in my horror viewing for a long time.
Oh wow.
The first time I watched it was probably shortly after we started doing this show because I was up in Easton. And you mm-hmm. always generously allowed me to paw through your movie selection.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the movies I picked out, took home,
yep.
watched it. I'm like, holy crap.
Exactly.
It was like, it's a movie that really knocks you on your ass.
Totally.
And something I love about it, right from the opening minutes, Bill, something I love about movies that do this kind of thing and do it well is that you start off, there's this chaos.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like you have all these questions and the film keeps going and you just keep loading up these questions. It's like,
yup, you
wait,
got it.
Wait a second. Why is he suddenly in the subway? why is he suddenly with his wife when he's living with Desi, played by not Desi, I'm thinking of Bliss. Jezzy, played by Elizabeth Peña.
Right.
What, you know, there's all these overlapping timelines and realities going on even with this film, and it's very ambitious, but the thing with that first viewing is you just don't know what the fuck's happening.
Exactly.
You're being jerked along basically the whole movie wondering, okay, who the hell are these people with the spinning faces? Why are these two mob guys picking them up? And why is the car like screeching around corners real crazy? Like, what's the deal with Danny Aiello's angelic chiropractor?
Yeah.
He's fantastic, you know.
Well, that's funny. Chiropractors actually come up to Adrian Lynn and say, thank you for presenting us well. And that's because he had a chiropractor on set to work with Danny Aiello to get it right.
You know, Bill, as someone who's been going to a chiropractor for the past couple of years, watching it this last time, I was like, that's stuff I've had done to me too. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and you're right about the whole confusion thing, and the whole movie is like this confused. It's a puzzle. It's, mm-hmm. it's Adrian Lynn shook up a box, a puzzle box, emptied the pieces, and he's thrown them at you piece by piece, and you're like, what the fuck? And you know, where am I going? And of course, you know, Bruce Joel Rubin, who wrote it, he actually wrote this in 1980.
Yeah.
Part of it came from a drug trip when he was doing LSD in 65.
Mm.
And then he had this dream later, and then he started writing, working on this script, and then it went through a whole bunch of like Hollywood hell crap, and because people are like, well, we don't want to make this movie. And Adrian Lynn was like, hey, you know, I'm supposed to do this Bonfire to Vanities crap, but you know what? I'll do this instead. I really dig it. And apparently they worked together for a year where, you know, Rubin had to make some concessions to Lynn because Rubin did a lot of very biblical-based things in there and wanted a lot of biblical-based imagery. And to Adrian Lynn, a lot of it he felt would come off as silly, and he didn't want that. Like, you know... Mm-hmm. There's a scene where everybody's supposed to be demonic, and demonic like in the way it's presented in classical, you know, medieval, you know, Christian, you know, productions of art. And he's like, no, he said, we're not doing it. You know, we're going to make, they're still going to be human, and they're going to be, which was creepier than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And well, we won't talk about the end yet, but you know, the biggest change was the ending. But
Yeah, you know, Bill, I did read up and see that as well, and I'm actually totally in agreement with Adrian Lind. I'm like, that stuff would have been totally cheesy and more. I find that when movies go for a more literal approach to those concepts, it does come across as laughable, especially when you're trying to place it within a genre framework. Just as a for instance, recently I watched I went through the Omen series, which is a pretty short series, but Omen 3, which is okay, the one with Sam Neill, that one's okay, but the ending is so fucking cheesy in that movie because there's this appearance of an angel, kind of like good has triumphed over evil, and it is the cheesiest fucking thing you'll ever see in a movie.
Agreed, agreed.
You know, so when I read about Bruce Joel Rubin kind of wanting to manifest things in a more kind of literal fashion, I was like, no, dude, no. Listen to the guy who's going to be running the camera. Listen to the guy behind the camera. He knows what he's talking about. Trust him on this.
Yeah, and I'm glad he did. I know Ruben still has that comment that, you know, the movie you write is not the movie you see. And I understand that and I get that, but I don't think that Ruben has any ill will at all towards Lynn because I know he's happy with it. And I have a great, well, fuck, I was gonna wait till the end, but I'm gonna give you the quote now. As soon as I could find it. And it was just really beautiful. It was, and this is from Den of Geek. This is from Beresford, Jack Beresford's article. This is the quote I'm extracting. I remain very proud of it, you know, Jacob's Ladder, and I think without Adrian Lynn directing, it would have never been what it is. Rubin says, so many films just disappear into the ether, but certain films stay with you. Jacob's Ladder speaks to the human condition. I tried very hard to make movies that offer different perspectives. There's a lot to talk about in their world, and it's hard to get Hollywood to make those movies. I'm very grateful I got to speak to the world. And that, as a writer, I mean, that's beautiful. That's just
It
like,
is,
you know, and he did. He spoke to the world in volumes, and it might not have been like, you know, king at the box office, but boy, that thing has taken on like a life of its own. I would hate to even say a cult following. I would like to say more of a critical appreciation, you know.
I agree with that, Bill, because I feel like this is a movie that I feel like just looking on social media, people bring this up semi-regularly, you know, even outside of an anniversary year. I feel like this movie is kind of in the conversation, which I think is a great thing because I did read that 25 million budget, which was probably pretty low even for that time for a Hollywood film, but like you said, there was that drop off after the first week, and I think Tim Robbins said something about how the fact that America was gearing up for the Gulf War might have hurt the film at the box office, which I could totally see.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm like, you know, I'm glad that the movie has the life it does, and that's part of the conversation. And Bravo included the dance scene
Oh my
with
God.
Elizabeth Peña as part of one of their 100 scariest movie moments from like 15 years ago.
I mean, that's the one scene I can never get out of my head.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to kind of why I like this movie so much is that you see these things happening, this unconventional approach to narrative, which is like, I feel like today it's probably a little worse with mainstream movies,
Oh, hell yes.
and everything being kind of handed to the audience. It's like, we'll explain everything step by step so it makes sense in the end. And yeah, you know, that's why I think of like the three act structure of a Marvel movie or whatever. Even though I enjoy a lot of Marvel movies, I'm like,
Same
come
here.
on, you know.
I know.
But with this, I'm just like, man, it seemed. For a 1990 mainstream movie, it seemed extremely ballsy for it to unravel in the way it did. Because even watching it a second time, granted it had been a couple of years, I'm like trying to figure out, like you said, how stuff is supposed to connect to everything else when it seems like stuff is just coming at you from all different directions without any regard for. I don't know, consistency or linear storytelling, which now it's like I love it, you know. I love that sort of thing, because when a director knows how to, and a screenwriter knows how to manipulate those elements to create a really intense experience, you've really got something special on your hands.
No, agreed. I think, you know, the nonlinear element, you know, some people try to use it as like to be tricky. And in this case, it, you know, that wasn't the case. It was because it's actually really a character study of Tim Robbins' character, and which I really enjoyed. And he's going through this nightmare. He can't figure out what's going on. Neither can you. So we're with him the whole way, like holding his hand. We're taking that bath from the fever with him with all the ice cubes. And all that crap, you know, and we're enduring what he's enduring as he's trying to unravel what's going on in his mind. You know, he's a haunted Vietnam veteran, you know, and it's funny because somebody wrote it, and I think they put it really well on IMDb. He has a severe case of dissociation, and it's like, and it's just wonderful because we're watching his journey and trying to figure out, like, he's trying to figure out the why behind the emotion, and it's just so wonderful because it's a mystery, and it's a solid one. But because we have such great strong characters and all the people that we mentioned, it holds the story together, even though the story is seemingly all over the place. And that's the beauty of it. And it's great because normally in a story like that, sometimes it depends on how it's done, but you could lose maybe a connection to the character. And in this one, you don't.
No.
You know, I'm just like, oh, come on, help Jacob figure it out. You know, it's like, you know, like, he needs an answer, man. And then you get the answer and you're like, oh, wait. You know, it's like,
oh. Yeah, it's like, throw the poor guy a bone. He's seriously going through hell. Yeah, like literally in this movie.
Oh my gosh. And as I'm like looking at the film, and I'm thinking of my version of the DVD that I have, I'm like, how come Criterion hasn't put this out yet?
Yeah, I'm kind of baffled
this
as to
perfect
why
it, for them.
Yeah, as to why it hasn't gotten a more high profile release, that's for sure.
Yeah, because I keep hearing of all of these scenes on the cutting room floor that I have to friggin' see after reading them. Mm-hmm. And it's like, holy crap, where is this? You know, what happened? Is there a director? Is Adrian Lynn? I mean, he's still with us. It's beautiful. He's 79. He's coming out with a great thriller with starring Ben Affleck.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thriller. What's the name of it? Hold on 2 seconds. It's Deep Water. It's coming out next year. It's in post-production, so that means it's all wrapped up except for color and editing and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's interesting. It's about a well-to-do husband who allows his wife to have affairs in order to avoid a divorce, but becomes a prime suspect in the disappearance of her lovers. So I'm like, oh, this is right up my alley. You know, like, fuck. And it's great. You know, and it's like he's 79, and he's done many films that people love. The remake of Lolita, which I really, really love. Jacob's Ladder, Fatal Attraction, which is fantastic. 9 1/2 Weeks, which has its awesome moments. Flashdance, Foxes was his first film. And, you know, but the cool thing is he's still got the grit with him, and he really brought that grit. He kept that movie grounded. Even though it's fantastical, he kept it grounded at the same time. And that's not an easy task. That's like, okay, making sure you have the right amount of salt and the right amount of sugar in something. It's just like, he kept it down to like the bare minimum. And and it's just, the movie has weight. You know, it's a heavy movie. And you're watching it, you're feeling it as you're, it's just, I just watched the movie Relic. I don't know if you saw it from 2020.
I have not. I'm a little hesitant about that because I'm seeing all these Ari Aster comparisons, and I'm not a fan of his.
No. The Ari Aster wishes he could make a movie this good.
Okay, fantastic. It's in my queue, so I'm looking forward to it now.
If I hear somebody do it, I'm just going to go ballistic. Ari Aster, I'm sorry, but you don't know how to tell a fucking story. Like
you need to work on your character.
Jesus Christ. And that movie reminded me in many ways how they were approaching the filming of it and all, reminded me of like a Ghost of Jacob's Ladder sort of thing with certain elements that they brought to it. And I was just like, I was getting that feeling, you know, right from the beginning that it's I'm not feeling, I'm not settling into anything here. It was really, I just got a shiver actually. I can't get the movie out of my head.
Oh, good.
You know, and which is great. And Jacob's Ladder, this is a haunting film. I mean, when I saw it, I think I stumbled around for a week. At the time, I looked like fucking Tim Robbins with the hair and all that crap, you know, and I was like, I felt like...
You'd taken an ice bath, Bill, right?
Yeah. No, I didn't take an ice bath and I didn't take the damn subway either. I wasn't going anywhere. My neck hurts. Go to a chiropractor. Fuck you. I'm not going. You know, like, I don't wanna. But, and that's what I want from a movie. I see these totally disposable horror films now. It's like, yeah, it's okay, whatever. And out of your head because they're just dumb or they're just lame or, you know, it's just, condescending, all of that. And this movie just, it sticks to your ribs like a good plate of food. How about that?
I love it, Bill. You know, I was going to say something to what you're saying about the weight this film has. I think a year later, and I bring this up because there's some similar themes running through both of the films, but I think the following year Flatliners came out, which deals with some of like the same spiritual and existence topics, but it's a totally inferior movie because it's so
awful.
It's so goddamn heavy-handed, and it's so conventional. It's like it takes your questions. It takes
and pretentious.
That too. It takes these potentially mind-blowing notions of like, well, what happens to us when we die? And it proceeds to do the most rote, uninteresting thing with that concept. Well, you got to forgive everybody so they can move on. Spoiler alert, but I'm sorry. I just saved you like 2 hours of your life if you haven't seen that movie yet.
I was dating an EMT at the time, and she couldn't stop laughing the entire film. She's like, that's not possible. You can't do... They're doctors? What the fuck? Ah! She was just, like, in hysterics. I thought I almost had to call, the hospital to take her away.
I love the training rooms that have, like, Baroque statues in them.
I know. I'm like, come on. And the funny thing is, because that's a great segue, you know, Adrian Lynn wanted to create, like, a gothic feel for Jacob's Ladder, and he did. Yeah. And it's like, God, he nailed it. I mean, they really nailed like everything. This movie's just, it's really a rare event to see a movie like this come together, you know?
Yeah.
To me, it's his best film. And I haven't seen all his films, granted, but to me, it's his best, Adrian Lynn's. And it was almost like early on, they were thinking about getting Ridley Scott for it. And a couple of other directors, which means I would have loved the movie, but there would have been one scene that would have pissed me off. But anyway.
Jacob was a replicant, Bill.
No! No, you bastard. But I just think it's incredible. Like, he really, it wasn't like, yeah, I'm going to shoot this movie. He, from everything that I've been reading, he invested as much of his time and life into this film as much as it was, you know, by Ruben, the writer. It was just, it was really incredible that that the writing could affect him so much, where he really, really wanted to make this film work when it wasn't like, you know, like I know he knew in the back of his head, there's no way this is going to be some blockbuster film. But really loved it. And it doesn't have an artsy quality to it where you could say it's like, you can say it's an art film. I think you can make an argument for it, but it's not, the pretentiousness is, it's devoid of it. It's just very devoid of any pretension.
Well, you know, Bill, and I think something that might play a little bit into that, and I've been meaning to say, is that even I was watching my digital copy of it on my, you know, 32-inch flat screen TV, I was watching it and I was like, man, even in high definition, this film looks muddy. It looks washed out.
Yep.
New York looks like looks like the end of the 80s pit that it was, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was.
And to me, I'm like, I don't really want to see a glitzy, glossy, you know, polished version of this, that's probably how Lind intended it to be. You know, these kind of drab earth tones, kind of a dull color palette. There's not even really any bright colors in this film, you know, until actually the very end of the movie. And that's just coming through with lighting effects. It's the film remains kind of earthy throughout. And I think that's something that kind of helps it skirt, if this makes sense, some of that pretentiousness, because like you said, it has that gritty New York feel. And just even with the weird scenes with Jacob and his wife and his three boys, like there's this scene in the room, it's right after he gets thrown in the bathtub with all the ice.
Mm-hmm.
We cut to this scene of him at home with his wife in happier times. And the room is like out of Frozen. It's everything is blue, you know,
yes.
Sort of this powdery snow blue. So it's like, okay, there's some little visual cues going on here. And, you know, but I think it's subtle enough, especially since the movie's structured as it is in this jerky kind of what the hell's going on kind of way,
mm-hmm.
that you don't really log it as something like, oh, Adrian Lin's being a little artsy here, you know. Watching it a second time, I was like, it was lost on me, because I'm disoriented, I don't know what the hell's going on, why is it cutting to this scene, how is this tying together, you know, trying to figure it out and trying to remember kind of as it goes along. And that's kind of part of the film is memory,
mm-hmm.
the power of memory, the power of guilt to kind of hold a weight over you.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you reminded me of something. One of the things that I liked about the movie when you were talking about the element, the muddiness and the color and the feel,
yes.
and the whole New York element, I'm going to give Tom Rolfe, the editor, a lot of credit for that. You know, I'm sure he did some of the coloring and all, but here's some of the films that he worked on before he got to this one. And he did work with Adrian Lin before on 9 1/2 Weeks. But, okay. you know, he had blockbusters like, you know, The Right Stuff. Imagine editing that, you know, and War Games and all. But he even did Heaven's Gate. But he did do the movie The Prophecy, you know, Prophecy, before this. He did Hardcore with George C. Scott. He did New York, New York, Black Sunday, Taxi Driver, I mean, French Connection 2. So it's funny because he knew the New York aesthetic,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know, and he knew, and you could see in those other films, especially Taxi Driver, what he brought to it, keep that movie gritty and dirty and unclean and raw and real. And he did that to Jacob's Ladder. The movie he edited before that was Black Rain. In 1989.
That was Ridley Scott, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's just really cool that, you know, he had that right editor help bring this all together, not just for the individual sequences, but, you know, that, like you said, that keeping that element of color even throughout, regardless of what was going on, even in happy times, you know, it's like, yeah, but it's blue. It shouldn't be blue. And it's like, yeah, it should be, Johnny.
You know, Bill, a funny little story. I just watched a Black Sunday for the first time. Have you seen it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
a million years ago, man.
And that makes total sense because, you know, the last couple minutes of that movie, even though you kind of know how it's kind of gotta end.
Yeah.
It's like the cutting in those last couple of minutes. Yeah. Frankenheimer. He gets it down to like the nanosecond, to the point where you're like literally on the edge of your seat thinking it's going to turn one way,
yep.
because he's gotten you so worked up. And that editing is fucking fantastic in that movie.
Oh,
so
yeah.
that made my night knowing that the same guy edited Jacob's Ladder. Total geek moment here. But There's just so much with this movie. I mean, we haven't even really touched on like the. I wanted to talk about the opening scene that takes place in.
Sure, go ahead, bring it.
But you know something I like, Bill, and how they establish that sense of disorientation from the get-go, is that, okay, Vietnam had that stigma around it, and right. I guess like a year or two before was Platoon.
And 86, I think Platoon came out.
Oh, okay, so it was a few years before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like there was still, I think, that stigma surrounding the Vietnam conflict, and you have this sort of opening scene of just kind of R&R among this mm-hmm. group, you know, and Tim Robbins enters, he's joking around with Ving Rhames, which is really funny, oh, yeah. actually.
Yes, it is.
You know, and then something happens. Guys start seizing up, and they start shaking, they start yep. having convulsions, and the camera all of a sudden goes from being really serene to like getting really shaky and handheld, and there's sort of explosions, there's a firefight happening.
Yeah.
You're totally thrown off.
Yep.
By the whole thing, because again, from the get-go, you don't know what's going on. Why are these guys reacting? What happened to them? You know, it's just fantastic. In those opening minutes, it's just, you kind of, Lynn kind of says, okay, all right, this is the beginning.
Buckle up.
You get 2 more hours of this. Enjoy it, you know.
No, you're absolutely right. And yeah, Platoon came out in 86. My favorite Vietnam era film and my favorite film from Kubrick. Full Metal Jacket came out in 87. And yeah. This was looking at Vietnam and the Vietnam conflict in a different way 10 years after it ended for the United States involvement in 1975. And people were starting to maybe take a look at it a little bit differently than even though like people at the time like grew up watching it, you know, it was on television every night, and that's part of the reason why like we don't want to show any war footage on TV every night, because people end up hating it like they hated Vietnam. So it was really interesting, because it's like, well, let's go below the surface of the political elements and everything else, and let's get down to the individual soldier and what that person may or may not have experienced and how it affected them as a person. And it was great, because you know, all of those films were starting to look at the those people as individuals. You know, they did it in Platoon, they mm-hmm. did it in Full Metal Jacket, and they did it in Jacob's Ladder. It's like, this is a person's journey, and they're in this conflict, whether they agree with it or not, whether they want to be there or not, you know, whatever. Yeah. And it's like, so let's see what happens. Here we go. And that's really intriguing to me.
Yeah, and you know something, Bill? The way Tim Robbins enters the movie, I can kind of see like the parallels between physically, kind of like between him and Tom Hanks. They kind of have they kind of have some similar body language. And in a way, Tim Robbins is kind of like you said, he's known more for comedy. Tom Hanks was kind of America's Cary Grant for a while, you know. People really I guess he still is, you know. People really love him, you know, and justifiably so, you know. I think he's a great actor, but I think Tim Robbins has
humanitarian
that too, you know. I mean, gosh, I was crying watching A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood a couple months ago, you know.
Yeah, I'm not ready for that. I know, bull.
Yeah. I highly recommend the regular documentary about Rogers and the Tom Hanks version. They're both mm-hmm. great. But yeah, bring tissues. But Tim Robbins enters the film like just this innocent, you know, you like him from the moment you see him, basically. He just, that rapport he has with his fellow soldiers, that's sort of subtle smile he gets. You know, you hardly know him, but you're immediately hooked into his character, because he has that everyman kind of, like Tom Hanks, that everyman kind of a demeanor.
Oh, yeah. And it's funny, because it wasn't like when I read, like, oh, Tom Hanks was supposed, you know, was offered a role and he didn't accept it. I wasn't like, oh, Tom Hanks. I was like, oh, shit, he could have pulled that off too, which is great. And I would love to, like, you know, have somebody ask him, hey, do you wish you had been in, you know,
Jacob's Ladder?
Yeah, it's like, oh, yeah, that's when it got away. but I think that's, you know, that's something that's also lacking. You know, I as we get to the end of 2020, I watch as many horror movies from the year as possible so we could do our best worst show, and I want to like stack the deck as much as possible. And I am watching one movie after another where it's like it might take me 20, 30 minutes to even remotely like a character. How bad is the writing where you can't set up something that isn't formulaic where I could fall in love with the character or fall out of love and then be emotionally hooked to the story in some way, shape, or form? And you know, and this is, again, you know, it's just such a film is such a great collaborative effort. You know, it's an Adrian Lynn film. It's written by Ruben, stars Tim Robbins. And, you know, there's these gaffers and editors and everybody else that makes the whole movie work. But, you know, to just do those little things in the beginning that grab you right away, that says so much. It's so awesome. And it keeps you right in the film from the beginning. And that's exactly what he does here. It's just really wonderful. Very engaging movie.
Yeah, you know, Bill, the word I would use for this film, for as jarring as it is and for as upsetting as it can be, captivating is the word I would use for this film. That's just like you're hooked into it from the start, and it just captivates you through all the sort of horrors of war imagery, through all the weird, potentially supernatural imagery, through all the disorientation that happens, and, you know, through all the heartbreak that happens through the film. It's just very and even though there's some stuff I don't like about it,
that's fine.
But you know, maybe I can bring this up and get your thoughts on it, Bill.
Sure.
Because something I really took notice to this last time I watched it was most of the characters' names are biblical in origin.
Right.
What did you think of that? Did you think that was a bit too on the nose? Because I believe was Jezebel like a temptress or something like that?
Yeah.
So that's, I was like thinking, why is Elizabeth Peña being introduced like kind of in a state of undress, like through this couple minute sequence? And I'm like,
exactly.
That's biblical right there.
Yeah. Well, you know, considering how Ruben, you know, envisioned it from the beginning, it was supposed to be a very, you know, a biblical thing and experience. You know, there's supposed to be this like portal stuff to heaven and hell and all of this. And it's funny because I'm like dismissing it already because like to me it would have been like a sledgehammer approach and it would have been maybe laughable. So I think, you know, and as soon as I heard Jacob's Ladder, I'm automatically thinking of Jacob's Ladder, you know, from the Bible. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't get around that. But I thought it was just enough where it wasn't, we weren't being force-fed, we weren't being hit over the head. If Adrian Lynn hadn't made a lot of those changes, like no, they're not going to be demons with wings, we're not going to, going to have angels floating, we're not going to do any of that stuff. I mean, then the movie we wouldn't be talking about it right now.
Right.
You know, because that grittiness would have been gone and it would have had a hokey feel to it. You know, that's why I like The Devil's Advocate, because it's like, all right, we're going to show you these demons and this devil and, you know, and whatnot. And they kept away. They had tons of traditional elements in it, but visually it wasn't. And it actually made it creepier for me anyway. So,
yeah. So, I mean, it actually isn't as it's not as big a deal as I'm making it out to be, because like I said, as the film was going on, it's like, as I do, I try to take notes while I'm watching. And then at a certain point, if a movie's really good, I find that the note-taking drops off because the movie's has just kind of swept me along so well. And that's what happened watching it a second time. So I can't complain too much about the on-the-nose names, because I think, you know, if that was kind of a concession in a way to the more heavy-handed visual stuff that was being entertained at the early stages, I think this was the smarter move was to go with the names, because that gives you just enough. I like that Tim Robbins' son is named Gabe, obviously Gabriel. the archangel. You know, so, you know, like I said, it's kind of a minor complaint, you know, and it's still like it's still really powerful, compelling movie. I had some
go ahead, man.
I think I had some questions somewhere.
Shit, don't look at me for answers. No, what do you got, man? What do you got?
Well, you know what? I think I brought this up years ago when I mentioned it on one of our early episodes, but how do you feel about the like introductions of characters, Bill, and then they're only there for like a scene or two? What do you think about that in terms of how it affects the story and the film?
Well, knowing what the story actually is once it's over and looking, I really didn't mind. I don't mind it if it's used well, if it's done well. I always go back to the performance of Alec Baldwin in Glengarry Glen Ross. He's on screen 7 minutes, 42 seconds. He blows that movie wide open, affects everybody's life, even though you never see him or hear from him again. And he got an Best Supporting Actor Oscar nod, well deserved for that performance. But if it affects the characters and if it has that ripple effect, but if you have a character and they're there for like a minute or two and there's an introduction, blah blah blah, and then they're gone, you don't see them again. But what happened in that scene with them has no effect on the character or the rest of the movie, then it's awful. And because I don't want to give away like the actual ending or anything like that with this film, they were all pertinent in their own little ways, and so I didn't mind that.
Put that ladder down.
You call
Ladders
yourself a soldier, you son of a bitch?
ladders for closers.
Oh my God. I
I
can
don't
see
want to
Danny
hear
Aiello saying something about it.
I don't want to hear any fucking shit. You owe me a ladder.
See, this ladder costs more than your car.
Where did you get this ladder from? The morgue? Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh.
But you know what, Bill? I agree with that. The inclusion of those supporting characters like Pruitt Taylor
I was
Vince,
just
like you
gonna say
mentioned.
exactly him. Yep.
You know, he's got a fantastic scene with Tim Robbins in a bar that's very kind of surreal. And then you have like Eric
The whole thing's
LaSalle.
surreal.
Yeah, you know, it's just these brief sequences where characters sort of come into Jacob's orbit or re-enter his orbit after years of estrangement, and then it's like all of a sudden, just as suddenly, they say, no, we can't. No, we can't see you anymore. We can't do this lawsuit against the U.S. Army anymore. We can't do it. No reason. We just can't do it. And you never hear from again. And I love that so much because, again, that adds to the whole WTF factor.
Yeah,
Well,
absolutely.
it's like, why can't they? I mean, why don't they feel that they can join up on this if they feel they were experimented on, in the military? So obviously there's something greater brewing beneath the surface. And something I really like, Bill, and it's something I believe Danny Aiello's character says. I love that he's a chiropractor, but he's kind of like more, he's also like a barkeep kind of. He's like
Exactly.
the guy who will listen to your sob story at the bar after everyone else has left. He'll be there cleaning the bar, nodding his head, listening to you, giving you life advice. And at some point, like in the third act, he says something about to Jacob, if you've made your peace, the devils are really angels freeing you from the earth, which is kind of a conundrum, I think. But I really kind of like that because that seems to escalate the film to another level thematically. Because you're thinking it's just this funky supernatural thriller horror film with people growing tails and stuff like that, people turning into demons and stuff like that. And then it's kind of like, I feel like it does almost start to mellow out a little bit. I mean, we didn't talk about that awesome sequence where he gets robbed by a bell ringing Santa, and then he winds up getting pushed on a gurney through like literally the bowels of hell in this hospital.
Oh my
It's just,
God. Yeah. Oh my
yeah, why
God.
don't you say something about that
No.
sequence? Because that's a brilliant, horrific sequence.
It is, and that's another one I can't get out of my head with the what he's seeing from being on his gurney. And I know when they were making the film, they actually jacked up the gurney, the one corner of it a little bit more so it rattle and make noise. And it's like, and so you have this noise, you have this desolate looking 19, it felt like 1970s New York, dirt and scunge and just, and these people that were like, are they people? And it was just, you know, and he's like, what's, you know, like he's, it was, it's funny, he was like freaking out through the whole movie, even, you know, like, actually, he always had this, he was always on this, this tightrope between freaking out and like going, what's going on? You know, you know, and just like trying to hang on to his psyche. Tim Robbins did such a brilliant job with his character. And yeah, it's just very disconcerting. And you're like, well, what the hell is going on? I mean, he was just like beaten up by Santa. It's like, what the hell is this movie? And it's not like, oh, this is crap, I'm turning it off. You're like, you're invested and you want to go, and you're on a ride with him. You're on a ride with the cart, you know? I think they even have the camera shooting up from like his perspective, right? From the
Yeah,
journey?
actually,
Yeah.
there's a moment when he's being wheeled, and I think what you were talking about, Bill, is there's like these creature people, but they look more like creatures. Maybe it's like asylum patients with like their with legs missing and stuff, so they're like crawling around on this weird grating that's above the in the ceiling. So he's seeing all of these people or whatever they are just looking crazy, covered with blood, and just looking worse for wear. And it's just like, oh my God. And then the more he gets pushed toward the operating room, there's like viscera on the floor. It's nasty. It's totally scummy and gritty, like you said.
That and the party scene are the ones that really stick out to me the most because they were just like, well, the party scene was like a big, like, shock. You know, it was like, oh, what's like, hey, where'd that come from? But,
Well, and that there's another thing of Lynn's technique, Bill, is that I was talking about the muddy kind of earthy look earlier, and that sequence is kind of muddy looking too. But he does something smart, and he uses a strobe light to kind of fuck with your perception. So Jacob's looking at Elizabeth Peña, and it's like, hey, what's that? Is that a tail coming out? But it's like, what is it's again, it's like another what is going on moment.
Oh yeah, and the music in that scene was such a great contrast because it was, oh my God, I can't believe I just forgot the song.
I don't remember what it is
I
either.
think the song, I think that was I know it appeared on the album entitled Hell, but who did it? Who did it? I forgot. Don't worry, I'll find it. I will find it, damn it, because I'm on a roll.
Inquiring minds want to know.
Yeah, I know. I have to come up with it now. Holy crap. La la, the closing. No, not that. During the dance scene. No. Okay. Oh man, I'm gonna hate myself in the morning. But this was such a great show, and I just ruined it.
You know what, Bill? I got another thing to bring
Good,
up if you
say
want to
it.
keep looking
I'm
for it.
looking.
All right, you keep looking. I'm looking here, Jerry. Yeah. It's George. I'm a lawyer. I'm not going to take your case.
Oh my God.
Well, Bill, I really like the scene with Tim Robbins and Matt Craven, because Matt Craven pops up in the periphery a few times before the actual scene with him and Robbins, where he's talking about how he was like a drug maker and he created this drug that was supposedly a part of the U.S. government's effort to get, I don't know, soldiers to have greater stamina or whatever, or increasingly aggressive tendencies. And
Better
what happened?
combatants, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And what happens is kind of the opposite of what they intended. And it's interesting because Jacob meets him at like a hot dog stand outside. And in the background, I thought this was neat, and I don't know if you noticed it. There was like a I distinctly saw a police car that looked like it was from the 1970s roll by. And I feel like, wait a second, are we going back in time? We are. We're going back in time here, and I totally missed that the first time I watched it. And I just think it was kind of a brilliant kind of subtle thing there. And when he and Matt Craven are talking in this like abandoned warehouse where their voices are echoing and everything, it's just this brilliant couple minute sequence of two guys talking.
Oh yeah.
And it's not like an it it is and it isn't an exposition dump. It doesn't feel like an exposition dump because it's so well crafted. And the performances are so good that it just doesn't have that feeling of, okay, all right, they got to say this so we can get to the third act and it'll all make sense. It's not like that at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you find the song, Bill?
So I did. James Brown, My Thang, and
Oh,
from his
okay.
1974 album Hell,
Nice.
which is excellent. And it's great because it's that such a contrast. I love it when it's done right, when there's a contrast where it's like, oh, this isn't good anymore. Like I can never listen to this song again because of X,
Oh, yeah.
but it
Yeah.
worked perfectly. And that's just one of the things that he did in this film. It was one of the first films, and all of the effects were physical effects. They were all in
Yes.
camera effects, and they do that like shaky head thing. They were the first film to do that. They filmed the actors at a particular speed, and then moved it up. And a lot of people say that elements of Jacob's Ladder inspired Silent Hill.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, yeah, it makes perfect sense to me.
You know what, Bill? And there were movies while I was watching it, and it wasn't in a bad way at all. It was like, oh, this movie reminds me of X that's come out since then, or there were a few that it Carnival of Souls popped into my head as like kind of a comparison to this, or kind of a forerunner to it. It deals with some of those weird gray areas of existence, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And I love that about that film, and I love that about Jacob's Ladder, and stuff like The Machinist, stuff like
Oh.
Shutter Island and Session Nine,
Yeah.
even, which came out after this, kind of
Yes.
they kind of create these really eerie atmospheres and moods where you're not entirely sure, okay, what's happening and why is it happening?
It's funny, I just watched Session 9 2 weeks ago again. It's the first time I watched it, and it's just like, damn. It's just like, they did such a great job. It's like, how come people aren't making strong story-centric, character-based horror movies? Well, it's like, where'd that all that go? It's like you go on like I don't know. It's like you're with a lot of horror movies now. It's like you're going on an amusement park ride, and it's like it shouldn't just be an amusement park ride, or it should have some merit. It should strike me in some way, like Relic did, the other day. His house, his house is great. And another way, it's not. They could have used Adrian Lynn in certain areas of that film, but they take a page out of Jacob's Ladder with that film as well. And it's a great movie. It's not perfect, but it's great. And I just love seeing that. It's like you can show us the fantastical, the incredible, but if you keep it grounded in human emotion and human reality, then that horror is going to hit hard. And Ari Aster does try to do that, but he's got to work on that storytelling. There's the disjointed transitions and everything else. And this movie is not disjointed in its transitions. They are logical, legitimate, and in the end, they pay off.
No, I absolutely agree, Bill. It's a very it doesn't seem this way when you're watching it, especially the first time, but there is a purpose and there is a logic to why things are done the way they're done, and that's something I really love, is because Lind went forward with that confidence that this was gonna work. At least I hope that's what he was thinking. I mean, I feel like this movie falls into place too well for it to be just a series of happy accidents.
No, no way, man. No.
That leads me to believe he was like, I want to do it this way. I want this janky editing. I want these timelines that seem to fold in on each other. these brief cuts, that don't seem to serve a purpose or seem superficial, they have a purpose. Sorry, Bill, I'm going to get off track. I wanted to ask you a question.
Oh, wow. Segues. Who gives a shit? Go
But
for it.
before we wrap up here,
Yes, sir.
there's a scene where Jacob wakes up. It's after the sequence where he's being essentially wheeled in the gurney down into the operating room from hell. It cuts to him in like a hospital bed in a normal hospital, and his wife and his sons come in to visit him. And at one point, he's laying there, he's all happy to see them and everything. And then a voice, he says something, and then a voice says to him off camera, "Dream on."
The evil doctor.
And it's this very disturbing voice, and he looks at the camera. Tim Robbins looks at the camera, but we don't see who said that. And I'm like, what is that? That actually that freaked me out, and now it's bothering me. Just because it's another one of those seemingly random things, I'm like, what the hell was that?
I know what you mean. I know what you mean. And I just think it was, because if I say what I want to say, I think it'll really give
Okay.
away parts of give away the movie. But
That's okay. Don't worry about
just imagine, if you will, everything that's happened in your life happening at the same moment.
it.
And that's my answer.
Ooh.
How's that?
I like that you leave it on an ambiguous note, Bill. That's rather fitting, I think.
Cool.
So I'm sorry about that bad segue, Bill, but do
No,
you
that
have
was perfect.
any final words on Jacob's Ladder before we scream it on out of here?
Yeah, if you haven't seen the original 1990 version, you must see it. It's fantastic. I hope you enjoy it as much as Johnny and I have, and millions of other horror fans and non-horror fans.
Yeah.
It's one of those movies, almost like The Orphanage, where it's like it can appeal to non-horror audiences, and it's just really well done. I think, as you know, I write screenplays, and you know, I try to make movies and stuff, and those are one of the movies where, and I know Rubens even said this. He tells film students, "Hey, man, get stoned when you're watching the movie." He said, "Get stoned, watch the movie, and then like go out and like do something." And but you don't really, I don't do that stuff. But I didn't need to be stoned to like watch this and be totally blown away by it and how it affected me. It is a trip, and it's got to be seen. It's just one of those horror movies that should not be ignored ever.
Yeah, I think there's so much going on in it, and it holds up to repeat viewings as well. There's a lot to absorb in it, lots of little details, and I think that's kind of how the best movies are. It's like
Oh, yeah.
they give you a lot to chew on intellectually, but they also give you kind of a feast for the senses, even if the emotions it conjures are upsetting or disturbing. So I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a great journey, and it's funny how it just that's one of the movies that really just stuck in my head, you know, and I can't get it out, and I don't want to get it out, you know, it's just really potent.
Yeah, I'm glad you loaned me your copy, Bill.
I'm glad you watched
Yeah.
it.
I watch all your stuff you give me, man.
Well, yeah, I have to watch End of the Line from you. I believe you loaned me that one. I have to watch that one.
Gosh, I forgot I gave that to you. Okay.
Oh, I don't forget, man. I keep a list.
You're a good man. Thanks, Bill.
You and Palco Designs. I have like, I can't wait to see Palco again because you know he has this amazing horror movie collection. But he's loaned me DVDs. Some of our, you know, as he said, "You're gonna hate me for this, but you know," and I'm like, you know, like, "Oh man, thanks for that horrible horror movie." But no, so I have to get. So hopefully we could all get together soon, and we could all. I could hand back everything that I've borrowed from you guys.
Well, I was telling Palco, I was cleaning out my room at my parents' house, and I have a Sterilite tub full of VHS tapes to take over to him when we finally get around to meeting up with him.
He will pass out. And these people are going to pass out because we're screaming out to him, Johnny.
Woohoo!
How's that for a segue?
Give him a nice bath, Bill.
Now, I don't know if this is... these are people who are on Twitter that you can follow and enjoy. They're intelligent, they're wonderful, giving, caring, beautiful souls. They're respected and appreciated. So Johnny and I do our little scream outs to them on the air. And they're all horror. They're all in a horror vein except for one, but horror nerds. So there's a nerd thing coming up and it fits. the first person is, I don't know if it's Jan or Jan O'Connell. 26 years, filmmaking, producer, director, writer, artist, creator, distribution. Honored to work on Seven, Last Man Standing, Romeo and Michelle, Spider-Man 2, X-Files, and I Spit on Your Grave. I just didn't know the pronunciation. I know who the person is. Wonderful, absolutely fantastic. Great with, you know, horror. I mean, you know the films I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. So check Jan out, or Jan. If I hadn't met my friend Jan, I'd be like, oh, it's Jan. Zach Puckett. Zach Puckett 6, to be precise, has a YouTube channel, UCDWZ. I have now seen 1,671 horror movies and can't wait to keep going. Here to talk about horror and make new friends. Zach is awesome. Great soul. I guess now we sort of have like a movie watching competition going on, but I'm 1,000 movies ahead of him. So he's got some catching up to do. But that means I could take a break for maybe 4 years.
There you go.
Around the Galaxy. What's that? That's the Star Wars fan talk show. Here's the geek coming in. The geek and the nerd, and we love it. And that is at ATG Cast. Around the Galaxy is the Star Wars podcast talk show featuring the people behind the fandom. It is fantastic. It is one of my favorite podcasts. It is beautiful. Pete Fletcher does it. And you can go to the website beyondtheblastdoors.com. Abhorrently underscore URS, that's abhorrently yours, horror movie enthusiast, cinephile, lover of the macabre and morbid, Mama Wolf, senior English teacher, yes! And she says, I say fuck a lot. My kind of English teacher, that's the way I was. She's out of Texas, USA, phenomenal soul. Another phenomenal soul is Summer Juliet, and you could find her on Twitter at Circle Midnight. Writer and pagan, loves animals, movies, music, and horror. All poetry that she does is copyrighted, and she's a wonderful poet. She's quiet, sarcastic, and an optimistic realist. And she's out of the great state of Washington. A friend of ours who's been on the show before, who we must have on again, Thomas S. Flowers. Degenerate. He's not. He's like a great family man, and he's just a wonderful person. Operation Iraqi Freedom veteran. And senior editor at Machine Mean, and he's an active member of the Horror Writers Association and author of Scary Books. Check out his books, please. He loves horror, barbecue, and when he shows pictures of barbecue, he just makes me cry. And coffee. He's out of Houston, Texas. Please check out his website, thomassflowers.com, and you can check out his books also under the same name on Amazon. Oh my God, hold it. Sip of coffee coming up right now. And this is perfect timing because Kyle Hester is not only an actor and a filmmaker, but he loves the hell out of coffee. So this is perfect. Kyle D. Hester. He is an actor and producer. No quarter for racism or bigotry. And his films, Preacher 6, which is you could also follow on Twitter, Zombie W.A. Shotgun, which is Zombie with a Shotgun, The Chair Horror, he's a pagan, part of the Blue Wave, and he's happily married to The Tracy Ray. And man, I wish I was there. He's from the Hollywood South area. You can check out his stuff under Kyle D. Hester or Kyle Hester on YouTube as well as imdb.com. Holidays Halloween. Who's that? That is Queen Halloween W. Holidays Halloween Radio on Mixcloud, Horror and Halloween, obviously. I didn't say the obviously. She wrote the obviously. She's into metal. Who isn't? Save the Bats, of course. And Her IRL is Queen Halloween 1. She's out of Smoky Mountains, Tennessee. And again, you could find her under Holidays Halloween on Mixcloud. She's amazing, intelligent, beautiful, just all of it. Har Lovin' Bones. Who's that? That is October Bones with an S. Horror girl, horror movies, horror books, coffee, another coffee person, great. Stephen King, Ray Bradbury, miss you, Ray. Poetry, reading, writing, horror family, classic rock, and the blues. And October Bones resides in the United States, all of it, everywhere, every territory. And finally, the Daily Dead. Who's the Daily Dead? They are Daily Dead News, Daily Dead horror entertainment news, reviews, interviews, trailers, and editorials right out of the great city of New York. And you could follow them as well at dailydead.com. Scream Out's over. Taking another sip of coffee.
All right. While you're doing that, people can find me at CrashPalaceProductions.com, where you can find my movie reviews because Billy's a nice guy.
Please.
And you can also find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Johnny Numb. There are no H's in those Johnnies, but there are B's in the Numbs. Yeah, and that's pretty much me.
B's in the Numbs. I'm going to name a band that. We're B's in the Numbs! And everybody's like, what the fuck are you talking about? We're a Johnny Numb tribute band.
I'm flattered.
That'd be so cool, wouldn't it? Yeah. I'm Billy Crash. You could find me on Twitter at Crash Palace and also CrashPalaceProductions.com for links to this show and more. You could also find this show on Spotify, iTunes, and about 30 other places. I don't even know what they are. Forgive me. That's how life is. You could also follow me on Twitter at Noir Kink for my Kink Noir crime thriller series. And I just started work on the fourth one.
Yeah, I saw that update, Bill. I'm very excited to hear more about it. Yeah,
I'm glad you are excited because I was already like 1,000 words in. I'm like, this is burnable. I need to destroy everything. I need to blow up the planet. And then I rewrote it, and I'm like, oh, that's good. And then I woke up, and I'm like, it's still burnable. But that's how it is. The beginning of the project, it's going to take a year, so or less, but probably around a year. And you know, just great to do something I can control because I can't control anything else in my life. So.
Well, you know what, Bill? I'm glad you're kind of like just going into one after the other. I mean, that's just awesome that you got an idea and are going with it. So,
thank you. And the fifth book keeps nudging me, and I'm like, I know what you're gonna be. Just stay away right now.
Don't distract me.
Yeah, because this one's gonna be different from the last four books in a way, and the fifth one should be. The way I'm thinking of it in my head, it's going to be insane. So, and this one's going to be insane in its own like demented kind of way, of course. So,
you know, I'm about halfway through Debauchery, and I'm like, I'm at this point where I'm like, okay, where's it going to go now? So, because of what the Houdini's run into, I'm like, okay, now what? So I'm really intrigued as to where it's gonna go from here.
That might have been the point of the book where I even wrote, I had the character Denny Bowie, you know, say, "What the hell am I doing?" Because I was like, "What's going on, man?" And that's when I had to put the book away for like an hour. No, like a day or two, and like go, "Oh," and that's funny because then you go and you read through. You know, not even your notes, but you go and you read through the book that you wrote, and it's like, I know exactly where he's going. This is gonna, and it's gonna work, and it worked, so I'm happy. So at least I hope so. I have one great review so far, so I'm really pleased with that.
Yeah, excellent. When I'm finished, I'll post something on Amazon for you too.
Thank you. And if you're still listening at this point, this is our 349th show. So Johnny and I have to come up with. I'm gonna. Put the burden on Johnny.
Shit.
Yeah, come up with something cool for the 350th, and then after that we'll do our best and worst probably of the year, and we have other great shows planned for you thanks to Johnny's brain. And Johnny's like, hey Bill, what about this idea? Okay, you know, so that's pretty much how that works. It's like, well, that's good. Didn't we have that idea 30 years ago? Yeah, I think so, but we never did it. Okay, let's do it.
All I know is I've got like probably about a couple thousand movies to catch up with before we do our end of the year show. I'm sorely lagging behind on movies that came out this year. And I'm like, there've there have been a lot of movies coming out despite the fact that it's been an abnormal year. So I just like,
Yeah.
I need to get my ass in gear and start watching some on the streaming services.
Yeah,
So.
tonight I have a date with Amulet, and tomorrow I think I have a date with Sputnik.
Oh yeah, I heard good things about Sputnik. I watched Amulet yesterday and I thought it was pretty good actually.
Cool. It's funny, I watched Relic, now I'm watching Amulet, now I'm watching Sputnik, so I have to watch like about 10 more other one single name only movies for the year.
Have you seen Antebellum yet, Bill? That's in my queue.
No, I haven't yet. I don't know. There's something about it that makes me just want to, like, eh. But I'll probably do it. I'm watching, believe me, I am watching movies that should not be watched because of our show and our commitment to our fans, all three of them.
You
And I
know
can
what, Bill?
name them. You can too.
I can name them too, but if, as long as those three people are listening, I'm more than happy to keep doing this.
Yep.
So.
Yep. Thank you, Vicky, Paul, and Randy.
Hey, AD,
D, of
Susan.
course. I know. Well, I had to name three. You had to name three. God, I miss D. D's awesome. God, I love that woman's brain. And Susan's just phenomenal.
And Susan is, and I'm happy that Susan's going out the gate running at Crash Palace with her articles. And
Killing me. She's
I
awesome.
know. I know. I'm like, oh boy, this is great. I gotta up my game now. So yeah.
You both have different styles and you're both amazing at those styles. With all the work that I've looked at, because I have two of your articles coming up, or one of, yeah, two of yours, two of hers I just did. Between all of that, I only had to add one comma. I'm like, you guys could do whatever the hell you want. You guys are fantastic.
You know what, Bill? I'm going to send two more to you in the near future for the queue. So, yeah.
Love you, man. All right, let's get
No
out of here.
problem.
People are bored to shit.
Yeah. Don't they want to hear the behind the scenes? That's okay. Go take some ladder and you'll forget this episode ever happened.
Aiello said it's going to be all right.
What you people's doing is barbaric.
I'm out of here. Goodbye.
See you, Bill. Bye.